Coming up on this week's show, the N64's answer to Tomb Raider is finally playable.
Get your retro consoles repaired on the high street.
And we go inside the world of Future Vision and Midway with our guest Lee Jacobson.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you every single week with our incredible mates at Bitmap Books. Now, have you seen their latest volume that everybody is talking about? N64, a visual compendium, telling the story of the console that changed the gaming world and covering more than 150 titles that define that system. Obviously, Super Mario 64 is in there, GoldenEye 007, The Legend of Zelda, Ocarina of Time, Banjo-Kazooie, and lots more as well. If you love the N64, check that out on the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our mates at PCB Way. Now, I'm sure you know about PCB Way. If you're working on anything retro at the moment, they offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they offer services like 3D printing and injection molding. And of course, you know that PCB Way are massive supporters of the retro community, so you can get an instant quote on their website right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 424, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the show. Of course, the podcast every Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the golden age of video games, taking you back to the 80s, the 90s, the noughties, talking about all those classic systems, those games as well. And of course, bringing you up to speed on what's been happening in the world of retro gaming and technology from over the last 7 days. And then second half of the podcast is when we bring on a veteran of the industry to tell us their story. Now, it's a really interesting one this week that we'll talk about more in just a second. Before we do that, though, it has been quite a busy week in terms of news. I did see some great pictures on our Discord of some of our listeners in North America sharing pictures of the eclipse that happened over there on Monday. I was gutted that we missed out on that over here.
Yeah, I think didn't we have one when we were younger? I do remember being on a canal holiday and we had the glasses that we got from, you know, the newspaper.
At the Sun. It's a newspaper, that is.
Yeah. And it did happen. I remember seeing an eclipse, yeah.
I remember, so there's one in 1999 that I think was the last kind of big one here. Yeah, and I remember rushing home and taking my dog out for a walk. And again, I had the eclipse glasses out the paper, not realising that I was actually too far north in North Yorkshire and it literally went a little bit cloudy.
Well, my dad's friend had a welding mask. He used that, just put that on in the middle of the street.
That's the thing, you've got to be safe. I did see that apparently the next morning after the eclipse, the most searched term in Google on Tuesday morning was, why do my eyes hurt?
Do you remember seeing those? It was like a little box and you'd look at like the shadow of it.
Yeah.
In the reflection as well, yeah.
Yeah, you could make those yourself, couldn't you? I remember seeing the instructions for them. So I was a bit sad that we missed out on that because I think it hit here about 8 p.m. So the sun had already set here in the UK on the eclipse on Monday. But yeah, some incredible pictures. And thank you to our listeners who shared them in the Discord. And the other big news, of course, on Monday that we'll talk more about in just a moment was that Nintendo closed down a couple of big services. The Wii U and the 3DS Online is no more. And let's keep an eye on Twitter because I was quite interested to see kind of, do you remember when the original Xbox Online shut down? And there's people like playing Halo 2 for about a week afterwards, wasn't there?
Just still trapped in the game.
Yeah, I think it was like,
I'm stuck in Halo 2. No, you're not. Just switch it off.
But there was people playing it for ages because I think Microsoft basically, they wouldn't let any new players join, but they wouldn't kick you off. So I was kind of wondering whether that would be the case with the 3DS and the Wii U, but it turns out it wasn't. I did see a few posts off people. There's one on Twitter who was in the middle of a game of Mario Kart 7 on Rainbow Road, collected a load of shells and bonuses, about to cross the finish line. Then all of a sudden they got an alert saying that the server's offline, so they couldn't play it. And I think the last person playing the Wii U, from what I've seen on Reddit, was a user called Squeaker, who was in the middle of a game of Splatoon. And then everyone else got kicked offline. It was a pretty sudden shutdown for the 3DS and Wii U. However, if you have got those consoles and maybe looking at them thinking, oh, they're going to gather dust now, we've got some good news for you that we'll talk about in just a moment. So all of that coming up in our news. Before we do that, though, we did announce last week, and we've had a good response to this, that if you wanted a copy of the Retro Hour book that, of course, we did run a Kickstarter for about 18 months ago now. We've finally got some copies available for non-Kickstarter backers. Our patrons have now got first dibs on them.
Yeah, we printed some extra ones as well. And, you know, backers of the Kickstarter as well. We've had a few that actually haven't still sent their addresses.
I think there's about 10 people outstanding I've emailed about 5 times in the last 6 months asking for their address.
So if you've not received it, then please, you know, check your emails.
Yeah, but for everybody else, if you are a backer of our Patreon, if you join us on Patreon, you now have access to buy a book on there. We've put a bunch of them up there and had a really good response as well. So if you'd like to get hold of a Retro Hour book, that's the easiest way to do it. Join our Patreons community and you'll see the form there. First thing you see on our Patreon at the moment, sign in, register your details, and we'll get back to you with a postage quote. And I'm sure Joe is looking forward to boxing up more books.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm ready.
Get those boxing fingers
you've
ready.
You've got it down now. You know how to do it. Yeah.
I mean, I knew how to pack a box before. You know, I'm not that quick.
You're just quicker now.
All those memories of those nights over Christmas, you sitting there all cozy with your fire on, boxing books up while watching Christmas films. So I'm going to be doing it again. So if you'd like to get hold of a book, do join us on Patreon. All the details are at theretrohour.com. Now, let's talk about our guest this week, because this is a really interesting chat we've got on this week. We're going to be talking to Lee Jacobson.
Yeah, man, that was a really, really fun interview. It was good to be on one. It's been a while again for me. But yeah, really interesting. Talking about the development of the cult classic Harvester was really, really fun and interesting and quite insightful, because Harvester is obviously, you know, quite a brutal, gory point-and-click adventure. And hearing, you know, the development of that game and, you know, how the HUD was made and everything, and Lee's opinion on horror films and horror games as a general was quite funny, but a really, really, really good storyteller as well. And it was great just kind of following his journey from kind of like the mid to late 80s up into the mid 90s.
I'm looking forward to really hearing this one because, you know, wasn't there some interesting technology using that? I know I always mention Amiga, but I know there was some Amiga stuff used in the digitization process.
Yeah, well, it was basically it was right in the middle of the FMV craze, really, wasn't it, when that game came out? They started developing it in 94, and it got released in 1996. And it was only a small team. I think you said about 8 people worked on it. So, you know, massive, very ambitious task for such a small team.
Yeah, yeah, and he kind of talks us through the whole process of, you know, the digitized characters and how they literally did it frame by frame, drawing ground every single actor, you know, and he did say if they'd known how much work it would have been and how long it would have took prior to doing it, they might not have done it, but we're certainly glad they did.
Yeah, and it's an interesting game because, you know, there are a lot of kind of games that grabbed the headlines back then. You know, obviously Mortal Kombat was doing it in Night Trap as well. The age ratings came in. But actually, this game, Harvester, really does live up to its reputation of being a bit of a gore fest. But also quite a funny game as well. It's a weird balance of like humor and, you know, violence pretty much. So we hear all about that. And also a game that they worked on in 1994, an FPS game called The Fortress of Radiaki. Now, I first came across this game when a YouTuber that I watched called Civi11, he did a rather scathing playthrough review video of it a while ago, basically saying that it was one of the worst FPS games, if not the worst FPS game he's ever played.
It's an interesting one. And, you know, we kind of mentioned that to Lee as well.
I was
and
a bit nervous mentioning it. Yeah, I was a bit scared.
Yeah, he took it very well. And he said, you know, they kind of succeeded in what they wanted to do. And
he wanted to bonkers.
Make, it's bonkers. It is bonkers. And he just said he let the team be bonkers. And, you know, they wanted the game to come across as a cheesy B-movie. And he said, that's what we did. That's what we managed to do. And it's
there's all kinds of weird enemies in there, isn't there? Like, what kind of things are in there?
Ninjas, alligators, samurai.
I'm looking at a clip. There's like a
robots.
A guy, I think he's in Lederhosen, and he's got a giant baby's dummy. Like, I don't know what's going on.
It's just mad game.
Who is Dr. Radiaki? Is he like the main protagonist in it?
You have to play it to find out, won't you?
Oh, good answer.
It is available actually to get again. Now they re-released it last year, so they're, you know, can play it on new platforms. But that's the thing. A lot of the press for it was basically them saying, it's so bad, it's good. It's kind of one of these games that you just have to play to see what it's like. So we hear all about that and the development of that game as well. And then, like you said, he kind of moved into working at Virgin Interactive, worked for Midway for a while as well. So he's got a really interesting history. So we're going to be joined by this week's very special guest, who was the founder of Future Vision Inc., that later on became DigiFX. Lee Jacobson will be on the show in around 35 minutes from now. Now, before that, we had like to have a little roundtable chat with our resident joystick jugglers, talking about what's been happening in the world of retro from over the last week. Now, I did mention that the Wii U and the 3DS have gone offline. And it's a strange one, because when did those systems come out? I think the Wii U was only like, what, 2011, 2012, around
2012, then? Something yeah. like that. 3DS was a little bit before, I want to say. Which doesn't sound that long ago, but that's over 10 years ago.
I mean, that's strange, because normally, you know, when we do retro, we kind of go back 15, 20 years usually. But for some reason, the Wii U kind of feels like, kind of falls in that category, a bit like the Dreamcast. Some of the kind of feels a bit retro now. So we generally do like to talk about it.
And I think the support for Virtual Console as well puts it in that kind of retro era where, you know, the Switch has moved on to emulators and, you know, proper releases. It still felt a bit GameCube-y. You know, the Wii U.
It's a strange one, because of quite a lot of my friends, you know, we covered BioShock in last week's episode. A lot of them were like, is BioShock retro now? Like, BioShock's not retro. It only came out in 2007. And I'm like, I know what you're saying. Like, it Xbox 360 doesn't feel retro. 2007, I mean, that's 2 years into the Xbox 360's life. But, you know, that's what, 13, 15 years ago now.
Yeah.
When we first started doing this show 8 years ago, we considered the Dreamcast to be completely retro. And that was probably wasn't quite as old as what BioShock is to now.
Yeah.
So there's children that old.
Yeah. Well, yeah. It's just weird. It's a strange feeling. But yeah, you know, it's, I guess the Wii U is sort of retro. And I think
it's, the way the compatibility of it is so retro. So stuff like, you know, having the controllers for the GameCube that you can actually have in the adapter, you can play some of the original titles on there with the original controllers. It's got that like kind of weird crossover, and it's also it's a weird crossover itself of a, you know, handheld console that you can't really leave the house with. It's quite a strange thing, the Wii U.
And I think the fact that it makes such a good emulation box as well.
Oh, yeah, that's what it's totally, totally really good at. You know, with that virtual console, having some of those titles, I've got it modded and I've got all of the forwarders on there. And, you know, you can load up stuff, but you can load up emulators in there. And that's what I mainly use it as, just a great, you know, retro kind of emulator. But also it does the Wii stuff on there as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's got a lot of different systems. It covers MSX, you know, it's just fantastic, yeah.
Well, this Monday, 8th of April, at 12 o'clock Pacific time, that was when Nintendo pulled the plug on the online server. So if you were playing, as I mentioned, you know, if you're in the middle of a round of Splatoon or Mario Kart, you might have seen your service going offline, seemingly forever. But we did talk about this, must have been about 4 or 5 months ago now, a service called the Pretendo Network, that at the time was in beta, and you had to join their Discord if you wanted access to it. Now it turns out that, because originally, I mean, the idea was this was going to be a third-party replacement for playing these consoles online, but at the time we thought you had to hack your console. You basically need to mod your Wii U or your 3DS if you wanted to use these third-party servers. But it turns out now there is a method that actually, this came around pretty quickly after Nintendo pulled the plug on Monday. Within a few hours, the Pretendo Network have now shared a new workaround that means you basically get access to its homebrew servers without jailbreaking your Wii U.
Yeah, so it's interesting. So we covered a story recently, which was about, you know, getting the Dreamcast online and some of the titles that you could play on that. And they were all hacked up. You know, it was like a kind of, there was Phantasy Star Online, which had its own private servers and stuff.
The games had to be modded too, didn't they?
Some of the games had to be modded to be played online and stuff. Where with the Wii, it's already there. With the Wii U, it's all established. And using this exploit, you can basically do a simple DNS change, and Pretendo's network, which is called Shutterbug, then gets put in place of you know, the old Nintendo network.
Yeah.
The cool thing about this is all the functionality comes back. So Wii U Chat, I don't know if you've ever done that. It's a video chat service. You can do that. You can basically have the Miiverse working.
Right.
So you can browse the communities, leave posts, start messaging people. The rankings are starting to work in games like Pikmin. They're working on Mario Maker, bringing all the levels back as well.
Oh, wow.
So got archives of that, but also matchmaking works. So you just go on a game and then you do matchmaking. It will actually find someone else on the Pretendo Shutterbug network. And the thing about that is you need a new account. So you have your own Shutterbug account that you create, and then you can have friends on it. You can add people. And it's interesting because on the Wii U, they have these like little speech bubbles on certain games, and there's stuff like in Zelda, they leave like notes in the water and stuff. And this makes the games feel alive again, and the kind of system feel alive and still active, which is really cool. And the fact that you don't need to, you know, mod your Wii U, even though I've done that, you can do this exploit without any modding and just get it going again, which is really cool. I can imagine, you know, they might even in the future be able to fire updates for the Wii U down there. Who knows, you know?
I'm sure they could, yeah. Because, I mean, if that's a good thing about it, the fact that it doesn't require hacking the console. Because most of these normally do, don't they, when they do the third-party services, or it requires it hooking it up to a PC or something and running some software on there. But I think this is so easy to do that I think anyone that is still playing the Wii U, it's a no-brainer to do this, isn't it?
Yeah, you do change the DNS, but you also put a file on an SD card and put it in, and that's it, really, which is pretty amazing. I don't know if this works for the free 3DS.
There's no mention of that so far. I mean, I'd assume, you know, I mean, I think that was one of the games that the Pretendo Network would work on there as well. But it seems like at the moment they're kind of focusing this method where you don't need to jailbreak on the Wii U. I'm sure if they can do it on the 3DS, that'll come later. But in terms of, I mean, I must admit, I've had a Wii U since launch. I wasn't aware of the Wii U chat thing you mentioned there, the video chat.
We need to do it. We need to have a Wii U chat.
I didn't know that was a thing.
I can draw on your face on it. It's really cool. You know, on the gamepad.
Yes.
Just drawing on Dan's face in real life while holding a Wii U.
With a permanent marker pen. But yeah, it's great that it's come back to life. I mean, I haven't played my Wii U online probably since I got a Switch. So how long had the Switch come out now? Is that like 7 years?
Like 7 years ago, 2017.
So, yeah, last time I played like, you know, Mario Kart 8 and stuff on the Wii U. Have you played them more recently than that, Ravi? I mean, is there still many people online?
Yeah, well, to be honest, I only get my Wii U out when a new cool mod arrives.
Yeah.
The last one was installed in Vice City and Sonic Mania. And I was like, oh, wow, this is on the Wii U. That was all modified. But now I'm going to go and get it back online, and it should be really interesting. But also a thing for me as well is, because I do use modded titles on it, I'm kind of scared that Nintendo were gonna fire something down that would, you know, remove everything or make it not functional say you're being a naughty boy, whereas being connected to the Pretendo,
you're being a naughty boy just on the screen.
But being connected to the Pretendo network, I don't think, you know, it's as risky as that for me.
Yeah, to be fair, you know, I think I've said it before, I've got a feeling Nintendo will probably rather forget the Wii U ever happened. So I can't imagine they're going to send any patches down to brick this, unless they've been really pedantic. But yeah, fingers crossed. So I think the timing of it's really good as well, because I know there were, looking at, you know, Reddit and X and stuff like that, there were a lot of people that actually dug their Wii U's out again on Monday, you know, to play it for like what they thought was going to be the last time. So the fact that this came out like hours later, I imagine there will be a lot of people who maybe got back into it thinking, oh, it's a shame it's going offline. They might still have them set up from earlier this week. So very good timing, I think, before people pack them away again. So if you want to get access to that, I'll link up how in this week's show notes. Now, this is very cool. We always love seeing these. Seems to be a bit of a trend recently about people kind of making their own modded systems and things into like handheld consoles. And someone's actually turned. I must admit, I wasn't familiar with this Rare PlayStation 1 controller, but this has now been made into a fully functioning handheld PlayStation.
Yeah, so this, it's a weird controller, isn't it? It came out in 2000, not long before, you know, the PS2 came out.
Yeah.
And it's, at first I thought this controller came with a screen built in, but it doesn't. It's imagine it's so hard to describe, but it's kind of like
it's for Game of Life.
Right, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah. So it's like a roulette wheel.
Yeah.
Basically, that you spin and you do the little colour selections on. But you're right, it is completely bonkers. Takara were the company that released it.
Right, okay. So it's kind of like palm size, kind of hand size, and it's a square. And then it's got, like you say, the big spinning colourful wheel at the top. And then all the buttons are on the front of it. There's no analog sticks. So, you know, you've got your D-pad, your square, triangle, circle, X. And then the L and R buttons, they're buttons rather than triggers. And they are just on the faceplate, like, of the controller, aren't they? So it was used to play the Game of Life, the board game, was it?
Yeah. And I could imagine, like, it'd be good for something like Wheel of Fortune, but I don't think it had the compatibility with it.
Yeah.
But it seems like a really rare controller. Like, this is the first time I've ever seen it.
I saw it earlier this week on Instagram, and I didn't watch it because I just assumed it was like a fake AI, you know, image, or right. It was just something somebody had made up, not realizing that actually what the reason this is going around is because a user, I'm gonna butcher this, a modder called Hario Sato has modded this.
From Japan. Yokohama.
He's put an LCD screen in there and essentially put a PS1 in there, made it a fully handheld PlayStation 1, complete with modded L&R buttons on the back, L1, L2, etc. on the back, fully working, as well as memory card slots on the bottom. Which is just insane, because it's a tiny little thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it looks nice as well. I mean, obviously the fact that you had that roulette wheel in there, it means a screen has to be round. So I'm wondering if you're playing some games. I mean, is stuff going to be kind of cut off the edge?
That reminds me, though, of the PlayStation design, having that round disc on it, you know.
And yeah.
Kind of fits quite well.
Yeah, it fits quite well. The screen itself is actually square within the round circle.
So he's just kind of put this. I see like a star field in the background. I guess that's just kind of where
that's just the bezel. Yeah,
right. Yeah, it's not the actual screen.
Bit of glitter, Dan. You know.
Yeah, looks nice.
Yeah, stuff. It looks good, but he hasn't got. Unfortunately, it's not big enough to obviously have a disc drive in there. So I assume there is some sort of Raspberry Pi in there, kind of, you know.
Yeah, hardware wise, he must have interfaced it with the actual controller, and then he's got something in there, you know. I haven't seen many details of what's in there online,
but, I can't imagine it's original PlayStation hardware. It's got to be a little emulation box,
more unlikely
controller, but looks very cool, I think. That's the only thing I'm looking at, is it would be nice if the screen did fill the entire circle, but then obviously, like I said, you're going to get parts of it. It'd be like cut off then.
Playing on a Teletubby or something.
Yeah.
I kind of like it's great.
So basically he charges it via USB-C as well.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it looks very cool. I think, you know, I love these little kind of handheld mods. So it's definitely one of the slicker ones I've seen. And it doesn't look like it to hack it apart too much either. It looks like it's quite complete. It doesn't look like there's not all bits of plastic kind of super glued or hot glued on everywhere like some of them that we see.
Yeah, no, it looks clean, doesn't it? It looks like an official product, you know, from all the images he's posted and everything, you know, the back of it, the front of it and everything. It's very, very clean. There's, like you say, no kind of visible damage or scratches or anything to it. Way beyond anything. I mean, we spoke last week about the other one, and it's like, I was about to say this is way beyond anything I could do, but they're all way beyond anything I could do.
Let's be honest, Joe. Beyond all our skills.
Absolutely. Yeah.
yeah, very cool. So if you want to get a look at that, I'll link that up in this week's show notes as well. Now, we always love seeing long forgotten prototypes that finally see the light of day. And it does kind of feel like the N64. We're seeing a lot of kind of lost N64 history being recovered recently. This one seems like a pretty big deal, though, because this was a game that was kind of shown back in the late 90s. I think it was originally demoed at E3 back in 1999. And then it was in development until 2001, when I believe it got abandoned. But it actually looks like this could be, they were describing it at the time as the N64's answer to Tomb Raider. And I've got to say, this looks really good.
I don't know. I don't know how good it looks. It looks all right.
Well, talk us through what it is then, first of all.
So the game itself is called Rika, spelled R-I-Q-A.
and it is a third person action platformer shooter in the vein of Tomb Raider, but it is very clearly, from just looking at it straight away, an N64 game. You know, N64 games have that look about them. It very much to me looks a little bit like Jet Force Gemini. The way it kind of looks and feels reminds me of Jet Force Gemini more than it does Tomb Raider. But the reason this has been dumped is it was a developer who is, you know, anonymous at the moment, who worked for a company in the 90s who were also working on many, many other games, which were unreleased or later got picked up and changed into PS2 or GameCube games. He also worked on the Die Hard 64 game that never came to be. And he's released this game probably because of so many other N64 games which weren't released, kind of surfacing. And he pretty much explains that he's got loads of builds of this game, but he's released
20 of them, I think, isn't
it? Yeah. But he's released 4 builds of it, which I think his name's Tenshu. That's all he goes
by.
That's
his username.
That's his username, yeah. And he's posted this saying, you know, these 4 builds I'm posting are the most kind of like made up builds. You know, they were the most far along before the game got cancelled in the late 90s. And, you know, it's a pretty complete game by the looks of things. You can stage select on it. So you have to put 2 controllers into the N64, and it's fully playable on N64 as well. It works on an Everdrive. He puts as well as other emulation technology, you know, on your computer, but it will run on N64 hardware through an Everdrive. And you have to put 2 controllers in. The first controller, obviously, controlling the game and everything as it should, but controller 2, if you press the start button on there, it will bring up like a debug menu so you can stage select. It appears there's no enemies in the game, though. It is just you kind of running around an empty, complete game.
Right, okay.
With around 10 levels on there. And I've gone through the 10 minutes of footage that Time Extension have posted, and I couldn't find any enemies. And I only found one scene where you were shooting your gun.
It's a like, future- like a pole, isn't it, or something you're shooting at?
Yeah, and you get a and there's a laser gun as well. The look of it kind of reminds me of Aliens, you know, like that futuristic square looking ships, you know, and it's all very metallic and, you know, kind
very colourful.
Very, very colourful. But even down to the characters, they're kind of dressed in that kind of like US Colonial Marines kind of gear. And they've all got like these laser guns and kind of like hookshot kind of things. It looks like it would have been a good game. I just don't see it. Like, personally, I didn't look at it and go, that looks like Tomb Raider, like everybody's saying.
To me, that was the first thing I saw was Tomb Raider looking at this, but I think just because the female protagonist is in it looks a lot like Lara Croft and moves a lot like Lara Croft.
Yeah.
Yeah, and kind of jumps a bit like Lara Croft. I can see that they've definitely took, shall we say, some heavy inspiration from Lara for the female character. It looks like you can play some male
in
character
in a
well.
Very kind of sci-fi setting as well.
Yeah.
It's not got any natural elements in it from what I've seen.
Because later on in the game, you see like
in the Unreal Tournament or something. You know, the rooms.
Well, about 5 minutes in, it looks like you're playing as a male character as well, who's a guy running around with he's got blue hair and a cape.
Which is very Castlevania.
Could be inspired by some.
to me.
Yeah. Or Superman, maybe.
What do you think technology-wise for the N64?
Yeah, I mean, I think if you look
at
this...
As a prototype, you know.
Well, I think this would have been, I mean, again, it looked like they were kind of hyping this up as like the N64's answer to Tomb Raider, which I think in 1999 probably would have been a big selling point, being that, you know, there was no Tomb Raider games on the N64. I think a lot of people would have jumped at the chance to play something similar to it if they went down that route of marketing it. It looks like there's quite a few frame drops though. It doesn't look the smoothest game when you get into some areas of the game, but again, this is only prototype build. You know, they might have ironed that out in later builds of it. What do you think, Joe? Would you like to play this back in the day?
I would have liked to have played it. I think in terms of, like you said, there's a little bit of frame rate slowdown and stuff in there. But in terms of graphical capability of the game, I think it looks like it's pushing the N64 to its limit. There's not too much smear to it, if you will. And there doesn't seem to be any of that dreaded N64 fog.
No, it's very clear, isn't it? Very sharp.
It's a very sharp, clear game. But I don't know if that's just because of there's no enemies in there, et cetera, at the moment. I don't know if they would have had to have changed that later down development. But, you know, the worlds, the environments and stuff, they look very large and very clear. And like I say, other games such as Castlevania 64, you know, sometimes they have that elusive fog covering up half the map, you know, just because of it's, you know, trying to cover up the graphics, like kind of popping in and stuff. But no, it looks like they did quite a good job of this. The company was Bit Studio, they were called. Yeah, it looks like they knew that what they were doing by this point, but I guess this was a few years into the N64's life.
Yeah, it's definitely not a polished product, you know, early on prototype, because, you know, he's saying it works on an Ava drive, but you also need two controllers.
As I mentioned,
When you're using it. So, yeah, it's pretty good, though, that it's all available and that they've actually put it out there. You know, maybe it could get completed, or there could be like a fan version or something like that by the end of it.
That's what I'm hoping. He says, I mean, he was working at that Bit Studio. He said basically the game got cancelled and the team got moved on to work on Die Hard and Thief World Rogue Ops. So they basically abandoned the game. But he said he's uploaded 4 zip files, which are the final builds of the game. So if you want to play like the last 4 builds of it, they're available now, but obviously there's no more after that. But it would be nice, because I mean, it looks like there's all the framework here, and obviously you've got the controls are all in place, you've got, you know, the main characters are in place, the levels are in place. Like you said, Joe, it just really needs the enemies, doesn't it, in there?
Yeah.
And then it would be a playable game. So it would be nice. I mean, I don't know whether, I haven't looked at these builds that he's uploaded, I'm not sure whether it's source code. I've got a feeling there might just be kind of, you know, executables at the moment. It would be nice if the source code was available so people could kind of finish it or build a game around it. That would be kind of the dream. But obviously, you know, one step at a time. I think it is very cool that these are available now. Because looking through the comments on the YouTube video, a lot of people were talking about how they saw previews in like Nintendo magazines back in the day. They never heard anything else about it again. Or maybe saw a trailer for it on TV. So it is cool that people can finally play the game, you know, all these years later, 25 years later. So if you want to check that out and download that build to play on your EverDrive. And there's also a instruction video that he did as well if you want to get it running on emulation on a PC. So I'll link those up in this week's show notes as well. Now, it has been a bit of a bad week in retail here in the UK. I don't know if you guys saw the headlines. Again, I think it was like a Monday. Busy day for news, that was. When Game, which is our main high street game retailer, well, I say video games, are really 75% toys and stuff toys. Like that these days. Yeah. A few video games in the corner. We had the news a while ago that they're stopping trading games. They're not going to sell like pre-owned games anymore. And it also turns out now they're going to be doing a lot of redundancies. It said,
you know, when isn't it a bad week for the high street?
Yeah, that's a thing.
In the UK.
We always say, you know, it's a shame that they don't do many video games anymore and they're trying to get into board games and toys and stuff like that. But I guess if, you know, all these, we know the direction the industry is going is digital. I guess if your bread and butter's kind of been eaten away, you've got to kind of reinvent yourself somehow. But they are saying that staff should be ready for redundancies that are coming, which is always sad to hear. But it turns out there is kind of one shining light on the UK high street for retro game fans, and probably the only kind of major high street retailer now that is in the retro gaming market, would be good old CEX or Sex, as they constantly try to get us to pronounce it, which nobody does. But now they're going to be doing retro console repairs.
I found this really interesting. So the headline is Sex, CEX, Kex, whatever you want to call it, are now going to be doing in-house repairs, but it isn't quite all as it seems. It is going to be a partnership with a company called Tech Center, who boasts that they've already done like over 100,000 repairs, you know, through their own kind of like online company since they started. And what it's going to be now is you can drop off your console, retro or new, into a Kex, and they will do a no fix, no fee for you. So you drop it off, they don't fix it there and then. It's not Kex who then, you know, sit there at the counter fixing it with
a soldering iron.
Soldering iron and stuff, unfortunately. They then post it to Tech Center, who will then try to repair it for you with a 7-day turnaround. And if they can't fix it, there's the no fix, no fee. You just go pick the console back up. So that's the key thing here. If it can't be fixed, don't worry about it. They'll give it you back. Which is quite good. I saw quite a few people moaning about this when I first saw it announced a couple of days ago. And quite a lot of people were like, oh, CEX don't know what they're doing and all this kind of stuff. So I've been on the Tech Center website. I've even seen people moaning about the website saying, oh, it's full of all AI images and, you know, they're not really retro people and stuff. But there's actually, I don't know if you guys have been on there, but they fix a lot of consoles. So you go on there, you get a quote, you can pick PlayStation, Xbox or Nintendo or other. If you go over into other, I initially went to handheld consoles and they had Game Gear and then the Atari Lynx 1 and 2. And you click on it and it will say, what's the problem? Is it a screen problem? Is it a power problem? You know, there's only 2 or 3 options. And then it'll give you a quote. I've done about 20 quotes on there, all different consoles, the 32X, Sega Saturn, Mega Drive. You know, I was just playing around with them all, and they're always £39.99. So it's £40. Right. So it's quite steep if it's a Sega Mega Drive, for instance, because of if you can get a Sega Mega Drive for less than that. You know,
you could buy a replacement, yeah.
You could just buy a replacement. However, they also fix, like I say, the Sega Multimega is on there. Mm. Atari Jaguar is on there. And they're all,
Jaguar CD even, they do.
Is the CD on there as well?
Yeah, Atari Jaguar CD is listed.
There you go. So 32X, stuff like that, £40 might be quite a good way to get your console fixed. And if they can't, there's no fee.
Yeah, it's interesting because, you know, love it or hate it, you know, sex is a kind of trade-in.
Secondhand shop,
Secondhand porn kind of shop thing. And, you know, some people don't like it. They think the prices are too high. They think it's smelly when you go in. Usually is, but...
Can't deny that, Ravi. Can't come this
But I think, you know, it's a good thing to have a service like this on the high street. There's a lot of specialists and people that repair it and stuff and do it online, which is great. And, you know, we know about them. We'd be like, oh, yeah, we need to get the capacitors changed on our Game Gear. General public isn't going to know that. And I think it's good to offer the service. It might cut into some of those people's work, though, in that kind of like cottage industry of repairing consoles and stuff. And to be fair, you can find it on like eBay, you know, repair services straight away. For like Game Boys and stuff like that. But, you know, I think this might be for someone who just thinks, oh, I want to get my Mega Drive working again. And they don't, you know about all of that, or they might not trust eBay or something like that. And then just go there and kind of get it done. So I think, yeah, it's an interesting kind of initiative that they've done.
And to me, the thing that appeals to me about this is, like you said, Joe, you know, I've got a Sega Game Gear that does need its caps changing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've got, you know, contacts that can do it, you know, that always like, oh, it's a pain in the ass to work on them. I do it when I get time, you know, and then it involves me packaging it up and all that, you know, sending it off. I'm wondering if, like, if I could just take my Game Gear into my local branch of CX and say, look, I want this repaired, if they would then package it up, put it in a box, send it track delivery to this service for me, yeah, then basically it takes a lot of that hassle out of it for me. And I know the fact that it's obviously a major high street retailer, they're going to be quite trustworthy. They're not going to lose it, you know. So, I mean, that aspect of it for me, it does take a lot of the hassle.
It's like getting your watch repaired or something on the high street, you know, or just getting your phone fixed, your glass replaced or something. It's just a, you know, a service that you can now kind of do there, which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's a good... Like I say, some cheaper consoles, Super Nintendo, stuff like that, I'd just buy another. But if I was to get my hands on a Sega Multimega or a Sega CD1, and, you know, it didn't work and I'd got it for cheap enough, you know, for a couple of quid, then I'd go, you know what, I'll give it a try, because if they can fix that for 40 quid and I can get something back, you know, some of these consoles are worth like 500 quid. And as you say, they're a trusted high street retailer, so you would have thought if it goes missing or anything, they'd replace it for you reimburse you at least. I don't know. I don't really know about that part of things, but it's definitely
honest,
worth pop.
This is what Game should be doing. You know, I think Game, if they want to survive, should be doing more kind of focused stuff like this, you know, more actually bothered about games than kids' toys and...
Yeah, it's a weird one. Yeah. It's a weird one.
Little plasticky rubbish products when, you know, you could actually re-engage with the gamers.
I think CEX are really trying to not rebrand themselves, but gain the trust of retro kind of gamers, because of they've also just introduced that now with their retro games, they now post on their websites and in shop whether the games come with their manuals and, you know, the condition of them and stuff like that. So they never used to do that. It used to just be mint boxed or unboxed, but now it'll like I'll actually tell you if it's got a manual with it, which is so much better.
Well, they're embracing physicality, aren't they, whereas you know, digital and kind of, you know, buying games that are on cards with redeem codes is kind of in game a lot, and you know, it's hard to see where you can actually make any money. That's why they've got all this other stuff at the side of it, where you know, CX have gone totally into the physicality, and that's what they do, you know.
It does kind of feel like they're trying to fill that hole where like other retailers, like, you know, GameStation, all that are long gone now. And obviously with Game kind of not in a good position, it kind of feels like, yeah, they're trying to make themselves kind of the go-to destination for video game fans, which I think is a good thing.
I certainly do that. You know, when I'm looking for games, it's the first place I go.
Well, their other bread and butter is like, you know, DVDs and Blu-rays, which I imagine that market can't be that big these days. You know, your average DVD in there is only a pound or two. So there's definitely much more of a markup on video games and old consoles. So,
smartwatches as well. Yeah. So many smartwatches when you go in there. It's like,
could be a nice, easy way to get your retro systems repaired at less hassle. So we'll keep an eye on that. And if anyone tries it out, please do let us know your experience with it as well. Right then, our special guest, Lee Jacobson, is on the way in just a moment. Patrons, keep it locked. We have got a couple of extra news stories to talk about just for you in a moment. Before we do that, let's take a quick second to give a massive thank you to a regular sponsor of the Retro Hour podcast, and that is our wonderful friends at Shopify. Now, we all get the biggest smile on our face when we hear this noise. So you know what it means?
You've made a sale.
You've made some money on Shopify. Now, that's the thing at the moment. It seems like so many people are starting a bit of a side hustle. Maybe you're not being happy in your job. Maybe you've left your job recently. You're thinking about becoming your own boss. Shopify is the all-in-one commerce platform to start, run, and grow your business as well. Now, they are revolutionizing millions of businesses worldwide. And whatever you sell, whether it's in person or online, they're there to help you successfully grow your business. And actually, we were talking about this before, because we're going to be setting up an online store to do some of our books, you know, to the general public soon, fingers crossed. You were talking about it for your Big Amiga show that's coming up, Ravi. You want to get one of their card readers.
I lost so much sales last year because, you know, my card reader wouldn't work. I was just sitting there going, oh my God, I need this. So, you know, having a kind of shopfront ready point of sale system is really important. And you know, just not being able to think about it, just have it there and ready to go with support as well for 24 hours.
That's the thing about Shopify. I mean, you don't need any coding skills. You don't need to learn design, anything like that. They give you industry-leading tools ready to ignite your growth and give you complete control over what you're selling and control over your brand as well. Even, I mean, we mentioned those, you know, shopfront ready point of sale systems, the e-commerce platform they've got online. They even connect to your social media accounts as well, so you can sell across, you know, Facebook, Instagram, even TikTok as well, which I'm sure us being what do the kids call us, boomers, which even though we're not, but yeah, we're too old to use TikTok, that's always appreciated. So they have got, like you said, that extensive course library, and they have online support that is available 24 hours a day, ready to support your success every single step of the way. So no matter how big you want to grow, Shopify will be there to empower you with the confidence and control you need to take your business to the next level. So if you sell anything at all, it is time to get serious about it today. So why don't you try Shopify for yourself? Now, of course, we've got you a great offer, as we always do. We want you to try this out. So how's about we give you a trial period of Shopify where you can check it out for just £1 a month? That is a no-brainer. So use our link and they'll know that we sent you. You help out the podcast as well. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. All lowercase, no spaces. Shopify.co.uk/retrohour. I'll put that in the show notes as well. And get ready to take your business to the next level today, thanks to our friends at Shopify. And get ready to hear a lot more of this. So thank you for checking out the news this week. I'll link up all the stories we talk about, of course, in our show notes. You don't have to Google around. I save you the job every week. Just check your phone app or ahead to our website. You'll find them all there at theretrohour.com. Right, then next, going inside the world of Future Vision, Midway, lots more as well with our special guest, Lee Jacobson. He's next on the Retro Hour podcast. You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest, someone who has been a true visionary in the industry and actually founded a company called Future Vision Inc. back in the day, which went on to become DigiFX and was behind games like Command Adventure Starship, the dark and twisted world of the adventure game Harvester as well, that's definitely become a cult classic, and the early FPS game The Fortress of Dr. Radiaki, which we'll talk about that. He also worked for companies like Midway as well, and contributed to the legend legendary San Francisco Rush 2049, and much more, which we'll get into during the next hour or so with our special guest this week, Lee Jacobson. Welcome to the show, Lee.
Thanks for having me, guys. Much appreciated. It's nice to always chat about the good old days.
Yeah, fantastic. Well, really appreciate you taking some time out. I know you're relaxing in your garden with people might be able to hear a nice little stream of water in the background as well. So it's a nice relaxing atmosphere you're in right now by the sounds of it.
Yep. Just relaxing on a good old San Diego afternoon.
Fantastic. Well, let's get into your history with computing, first of all, because I heard that you started with the now legendary Atari 400 computer. So why did you get that machine, and what memories have you got of the Atari 400?
Wow. Yeah, it's so funny. I literally, to this day, still have that beat up, broken down, that doesn't work anymore, Atari 400 computer out in my garage.
Wow.
I've been trying to find a place that can, you know, put it back together for me with my Atari Basic cartridge where I first started to learn to program. But, you know, the best laid plans of mice and men, I suppose, but I haven't gotten around to it yet. But yeah, you know, I was, I went to a private school and graduated when I was 16, and I was all set to disappoint my family. I was going to go fly jets at the United States Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. And I started playing with my Apple computer at first. And then I saw, wow, here comes this computer that does a lot more colors back than the Apple did back in the day. I called it using a Jita chip, 65 CO2 processor. And were all these colors and wonderful things and games. And I really started getting into like games on the 400 back, Richard Garriott's games, you know, the Ultimas 1s and 2s way back in the day, right? And, you know, the bug just hit me. And I got a computer and I got the basic cartridge and I started to code and learn. You know, back in 1982, 83, you know, there were no video game colleges. Just didn't exist. There was no such thing. You could learn stuff like BASIC and COBOL and Fortran and all these that manical things, but it wasn't fun, you know. And so one day I walked in and a couple of years before that, I'd gotten an Atari computer, a 2600 that everybody's, you know, got stories around, and wake up on Christmas morning and play Centipede and Asteroids and all my favorite, you know, games. And then for Christmas, I got the Atari 400 computer and I could not stop. I couldn't stop it. So I learned to program and learned to code. You know, one day I walked into the kitchen and told Mom and Dad, I didn't want to fly planes for a living. I wanted to write video games. Now, besides them turning three different shades of white, they were on cassettes. Games were on cassettes in little baggies and 5 1/4 inch floppy disks. And it was almost like, you know, selling a drug deal, you know, back then in little baggies. Hey, man, I'll sell you this little copy for $5 and I'll sell you this copy for $5. There was no market, right? There was
definitely a cottage industry back then, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it was very crazy. And, you know, thank goodness there became a real industry around it. And from then on, I just started writing games. Nothing really meant too much, but went to an engineering school, not even around anymore, for God's sake, in Dallas, and learned to program and started writing games and just figuring out what worked and what didn't work. And eventually started a multimedia company doing advertising, but then said, you know what? I want to do a game. And we basically started building. The first game we'd worked on was, I'm a big Dallas Cowboy fan, unfortunately, for those of you who love, they hate the Cowboys, called Tom Landry Football. Right. And, you know, it was a wonderful thing back then. Of course, the games were, you can imagine, and in 91, very, very rudimentary. And from that point, I just really got the bug and started my first computer company and you know, went from there. Some games were miserably horrible. Some did better than others. Some, like Harvester, which I still can't imagine to this day, took off and became a crazy, crazy long-selling, long-tailed game, you know, over the years. So,
well, I'm quite interested in that move because you mentioned then that you had a career in IT and systems programming. I mean, how did you kind of make the move into video games then? Was that always kind of your passion that you wanted to work in gaming?
Yeah, I mean, I had to go to basic engineering school to learn sort of, you know, if then else, while then, do all the usual Pascal, you know, and coding sort of structures, right? Because all coding and engines has a framework, right? Just different syntax, right? And but nothing really was geared towards, you know, back then Sprite programming or Grat programming or it was really all business engineering. But I wanted it as a construct. So I went and took the base of that and then just read everything I could. There was a magazine back in the day called Antic, A-N-T-I-C magazine. And it always had a bunch of stuff you could type in on your computer. They were basically, you know, 10 lines of basic code in about 9 million lines of hex you type in. And of course, wow. One wrong letter, you know, a zero or an E or an A and 10, you know, I say 10 million, you know, thousands and thousands of lines, you know, crashes everything, right? So basically you go back and debug over and over and over and over and over and over again. So you sort of just, in some ways, you know, basic structures taught me how to think the right way. And then practicality of failing just hundreds of times of doing everything the wrong way led me down more of the graphics and engineering side because it didn't exist, you know, and that was where my passion really was.
So when you founded Future Vision Inc. in 1991, what was the kind of initial vision of the company? What was your, you know, was it, I'm just going to make some games, or was it like, I'm going to make the number one best-selling game in the next couple of years?
I really wasn't that smart. I was young. We wanted to jump in. Like I said, the Tom Landry guy, my project gave me the first entry into like the bug of doing something that comes to life on a screen. I think the next game that we had sort of decided on as a team, really as a group, it wasn't any one person's sort of vision. But I was a huge fan of top-down RTS games like Warcraft 1. You know, I loved those kinds of games. And I loved the characters, and you know, you the more you click the character, the different sounds it had, and different things. And I wish I could say honestly, guys, there was a grand plan. To be the biggest, baddest, and whatever it is, but it really wasn't. It was try to app build for the first time. You know, can you put a team together? Can you go through the process of starting from nothing, building something, but with a twist? And the twist for us was, you know, how do we? I mean, it's kind of weird now that I look at it. Look like No Man's Sky and Bethesda and some of the games where. Knows if there's infinite places to go, but they simply recreate different assets, right? Back then, you know, Commander of the Starship wanted to have like, you know, unlimited planets where you could fly around with your ship and do space battles, board ships, you know, randomize the tiles, kill the bad guys, get the loot, board your ship again and go to some way out desert planet, a nice planet, all the usual sort of, you know, trite, you know, different environments that you have, land, take your squad, attack, take over the territory, grab the loot, rinse and repeat. But instead of just sort of, you know, one planet, we decided our little hook was going to be, let's just make it where you can play it like forever. Let's just randomize everything all the time and keep them going. And that was just, I mean, again, there was no, I'd love to say there's a grand plan for all of that, but it's sort of just, it really is true, you know, years later. When I went to work for Virgin Interactive in Irvine, California, Brett Sperry and Lou Castle, who ran Westwood Studios, my old bosses, you know, I remember them saying, you know, and I didn't know at the time, which was, you know, you can't plan an entire game out no matter how hard you try.
Yeah.
Give it up because it's going to change 1,000 times over. And until you do it, you iterate it and you see how it plays, you see how it feels, and you see whether you have something. You may go down a completely different path. So to script everything out and write out, you know, the entire game plan from the beginning is just a lost cause. And I learned that firsthand with every product that I worked on, you know.
That was one of the first titles that Future Vision released was Commander Venture Starship.
I mean, it was the very first one, right? We cut our teeth on it, yeah.
So where did the idea come from for that then? How did it come to life?
Well, I think some of us really like I said, the real-time strategy, you know, top-down, three-quarter isometric sort of gameplay, you know, whether you lot of people love Doom 2 that Westwood Studios did. And those kinds of games, SSI had certain kinds of games you guys might have heard of those guys. We were a fan. A lot of us were fans of those kind of, whether it's turn-based. I liked real-time because it made you think on your feet a lot faster rather than plan things out in a grand strategy. You know, nothing's worse than having a million orcs flood your base at the same time to really keep you on your toes, right? And we wanted that same sort of, at least we tried, that same sort of visceral feeling, but one that could expand on way more than just, you know, one or two planets or various things. We wanted to try to bring an element of randomization meets real-time strategy that you could play for as long as you wanted. And it was really, honestly, I can't take credit for all of that. I think it was really a team effort by the art team, you know, the engineering team and the production team. We really all collaborate. And you had to, because back then, you know, their teams weren't huge. Now they're huge. And, you know, some teams were 100, 200 people or more. We had, you know, 8 guys in a room and we just fought it out until we made a decision. we kind of just did. But I think it really just gravitated towards the kinds of games that we like to play at the time.
You mentioned, you know, Dune 2 there, you know, having a big influence on it, and, you know, you were a fan of Warcraft 1. Did you have a big kind of sci-fi background? Were you a big fan of kind of like 70s, 80s sci-fi? And did that help kind of shape the narrative of the game?
Absolutely. And I still am to this day. I literally am watching TV in the backyard here, and I got Star Trek Deep Space Nine on every day, 24 hours.
Oh, nice.
And my team gives me a rough time because I have all these sci-fi show. And it's not that I even don't know the show inside and out word for all the episodes for the past umpteen years. It's just like, you know how you have white noise in the background while you're doing other things?
Yeah.
Because you really don't need to pay attention to it. You just kind of have it on in the background. I've always been that way. I've always been a sci-fi nut. And I never grew up and I don't have children. So my girlfriend says, you don't need any because you're basically a big kid. And I play video games.
Nice.
Even to this day, I just go in and I finished Halo Infinite. Now I'm on Cyberpunk and now finished Ubisoft's, you know, Assassin's Creed. Now I should keep going. So it's something that I have always loved to do. And I think it gets in your blood. I got fortunate.
100%. Well, I mean, when we move on from that game into 1994, obviously the first-person shooter craze was in full swing by then.
And
you release the FPS game The Fortress of Dr. Radiaki. So tell us the story behind that title then, because, I mean, obviously it was a very competitive landscape at the time in the world of FPS games.
Oh, wow. You're going to the Wayback Machine now. You know, so, you know, the gentleman who was really talented that worked with me on the game, it was a group effort, but Gilbert Austin, who came from the Wing Commander Origin days back in the day, really creative guys. And he said, hey, I want to do something that's just like, and I think you might have alluded to it in your email, something that is just so wacky off the wall. In some ways, it's so off the wall. It doesn't make sense. But when you play it, you almost had to laugh half the time because it was just so funny and wacky, you know? Yeah. And I think that's kind of where the nexus from it. And out of that, of course, came ideas from the team and whatever. But I just let Gilbert go crazy, you know, with writing some cool stories and stuff like that. But yeah, it was really meant to be a campy first person shooter. I look at it back in the day and I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we did that. But that's the way it was back in the day, you know? It was a way to have fun in something that was traditionally not normally you'd see in a game, that's all.
Do you think that helped it, you know, set it apart from the likes of Doom and kind of like other kind of Doom clones of the time? Because obviously, as you say, they were all very serious, very tough, and then all of a sudden you've got this camp, wacky one. Do you think that helped it sell?
Well, no, I don't know. I think it was just one of those. Certainly, I would have loved to have done the sales numbers that Doom did. I'd be happy with that, right? That would have been fine. you know, I think back then, you know, it was really more of a, I mean, everybody wanted to, you know, to be a hit and make money in every game to make money for the team.
Yeah,
but I think at the end of the day, it was exercise number two on bringing together the team again and learning from all the failures and the mistakes that happened on the first game. And you learn as you learn and you learn, and you know, it just evolves over time until you say, hey, we have a product. And so sure, I would have loved to have been more of a commercial success, but you know, everybody has, you know, winners and losers, and that's, otherwise there wouldn't be a Hollywood business, right? So
yeah.
but it was, you know, they were fun projects to work on because it was the early days, you know, of gaming. Again, no one really knew where it was going to go, but it was a way to express ourselves as a team and as a group and to let out being a kid all over again, you know, kind of thing.
Well, that game was quite a mixture of action, and there was puzzle solving elements in there as well. I mean, is that something you have to, like, you know, approach it? A bit of a balance, you know, with those gameplay aspects to make sure that it's easy to understand for the player.
Yeah, that's the goal. I mean, that's the goal. You try to do that. You try to balance it. And that's where you, you know, you think this level is going to be fun. And you go back and you play it. You realize, oh, that's the most horrible level that we ever came up with. And then you'd scrap it. And then you'd redo it. And then you'd redesign it. And then you rinse and repeat. You do it all over again until you're happy with the product. So it was always a balancing act, and I'm sure to this day, you know, all my friends in the gaming industry, I've been doing this for quite a while. In spite of how many people talk about processes and scrums and stand-up meetings and all the different things, you know, that people try to say they, you know, have these refined processes of gaming, I still believe that, but there's an old saying, Jack Welch used to run a company called GE, you know, candor in a Ford room and candor with a team and candor amongst a group is the only way you keep something great or make something great. And so we would argue like cats and dogs, you know, this lizard ought to be green. This thinking, this character ought to be orange with flame coming out of his eyes. Nobody was right or wrong. It was just an expression, a bunch of group of guys wanting their inner kids to come out.
Yeah.
You know?
I imagine even designing like a 3D FPS engine back then was quite a challenge.
It was. It very much was. Because we didn't, you know, I don't know, you know, we didn't use any other third-party engine to my knowledge. I mean, gosh, it's been so long on that one, guys. I have to go back and look. The engineering team kind of took the lead on that. But, yeah, it was, certainly wasn't something that you could just grab off the shelf like Unreal 5 and slap some, you know, assets together and have guys jumping around in a sword battle. It was all a lot different back then. And in some ways, it was a lot harder because there were no, you know, strong tools like, you know, Epic's, you know, engine or Unity's engines that allowed you to easily bring in characters, behaviors, and AI and you know, auto pathing and all the different things you can do. You had to write it off from the ground up, and there was no Visual Studio. I don't know if you, how old you guys are or not, but it used to use what's called, you know, Wacom 32 C++, which is, you know, a DOS-based sort of command language coding like in the old days. And there was no visual GUI to guide you through easily spotting, you know, that one memory overwrite error that caused your entire game to crash in 300,000 lines of code that you had to go through every time to find out where the problem was. So it was quite a brute force task back in the day, you know.
Even the hardware it was running on, I mean, 1994, that'd still be, it was probably even pre-Pentium. It would have been 486s with probably 8 megabytes of RAM. So
it was. It totally was. And then they were slow as, I mean, compared to now, you know, maybe, but, you know, it was definitely a challenge. But you know what? When the nice thing about it is when you're young and you think you can take the world by storm, you tend to overlook, you know, you tend to be what Bill Gates called an optimist pragmatist, which is where, you know, I'm optimistic we're going to pull this off, but I still need enough money in the bank just in case we don't have enough for the runway. You know what I mean? There's always that balance of trying to manage all of it at the same time, but yet you still like run straight towards the enemy without any fear of getting killed, you know, in the battle, you know.
Well, if people want to play The Fortress of Dr. Radiaki, that was re-released in 2023. And I saw when it was re-released, it was kind of quite humorously critiqued by some gaming websites and a few YouTubers as well. I know that Civi11, he did like an in-depth video into this where they actually kind of say the game is almost so bad that it's actually good. I mean, do you think that's kind of a fair assessment of the game, do you think?
Well, if that were the case, then we did our job in that way because it was meant to be so over the top crazy with samurais and alligators. I mean, who does that? I mean, who does that? Right. Who does that? So I'd probably say it's he's pretty accurate in his assessment, but I didn't think for the longest time there'd ever be a resurgence of classic games like that ever, you know, coming back to market. And, you know, I'm glad to see that a lot of hard work, even though it doesn't look like it today, some people enjoy it.
It lives on, yeah.
So speaking of games that live on or got a cult following, in 1996, the cult point-and-click classic Harvester was released, known for its dark and disturbing themes. What motivated you to kind of explore such unconventional territory in a video game at the time?
That is probably the weirdest one of all in so many ways. Again, working with Gilbert on the story, when he came to me and we started talking about the idea, he said, look, I really want to do something that's like just over the top. Back then, you had a game called Phantasmagoria that was also coming out. And it was a Roberta Williams game. Mortal Kombat was getting gross, and of course, you know, whatever. And I remember, you know, Joe Lieberman wanting to ban a bunch of games. I think mine was one of them and a bunch of others. But the weird thing about it is, I got to tell you guys, I told him, I said, look, do whatever you want. Just go crazy. You know, just go crazy. Go nutso. I mean, just go over the top and over the moon. If we're going to do it, let's just go for broke. You know, and it was one of the larger budgets we had. And I forget what it was, but back then, yeah, there was a lot of point and clicks. I loved the King's Quest stuff and the Space Quest stuff that, you know, CUC had and Sierra. And, you know, the point and clicks were kind of like really good because you could tell the story in your own way and click what you want on an exam. And it was just great thought processes, you know. And I loved that kind of stuff. And some of the team did too. And let's said, look, let's still just draw 3D sprite characters. Let's film it with real actors. So we had a big studio in a warehouse and painted the whole thing ourselves, green screen, huge, massive green screen, and rented cameras. And literally, I mean, that they do it, of course, but better today, but from Steve the character and all the characters in the game, everything literally was hand edited frame by frame by frame and massaged by hand by frame one at a time for the entire game. And I gotta tell you, I can't tell you how much meticulous work the team had put in to that game to do it all hand drawn. Because back then, you know, there'd be halo effects around the green screen. Colors wouldn't always saturate right. They would look right. There'd be look like Star Wars. You know, the blue aura would be around some characters.
Yeah.
You have to clean them up, and it was crazy. It was just really, 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 really hard to do. And yeah, the funny thing about this, you're probably looking at one of the few people who has never even watched a horror movie. I've never watched Freddy Krueger or Friday the 13th or Halloween or anything like that. I just really don't. I prefer Pixar Disney movies. I just always have. So here I am, you know, producing, you know, one of the most goriest, over the top, raucous, you name it, video games at the time, never watched the scary movie. It was weird. You know, I told him to just have at it. Out of it came, you know, a lot of disturbing imagery and a lot of people, you know. I got a lot of hate mail, or back then, hate email, phone calls back then, believe it or not. And it was weird. And we, you know, we shipped the game. It did okay. It didn't do great. Virgin picked it up for Europe, which was great, and helped move a lot of units back then. But, you know, then it sort of just did its thing, and there was no such thing as digital distribution. So we shipped it. It did its thing. It did its run. And we were done, you know. But it was definitely the most complex effort we'd ever done. It was definitely our biggest bite at the apple. And I always sort of, you know, being in the game business for as long as I have, part of my job at Midway was I was basically a showrunner, right? I would go out and look at 100 games and we'd sign three, right? And I'd take them to our committee, and then think games like The Suffering, games like Mortal Kombat Shaolin Monks, and games that, you know, I was really fortunate enough to, that was my favorite part, is finding that diamond in the rough, working with the teams and polishing them and getting them to be franchises for the company. And, you know, going back and building something like that is really, really, really probably was, you know, the most fun I've ever had is being directly involved, as opposed to now where it's all taxes and lawyers and accountants and CPAs and all the other sort of other things that you deal with. But it was really a fun title. And what has been really surprising to me, and every once in a while somebody will send me a message, and, you know, right around Halloween for some weird strange reason, they'll have entire parties built around that. They'll have t-shirts made. I'm not trying to make money off the t-shirts. They can have fun all day long. They make robes, they make costumes. They have parties. They know the characters. They talk about. They really go into things that, you know, honestly, they theorize and speculate on all kinds of things that they go deeper than we ever imagined that anybody would go to talk about just the story and the backstory and everything of the characters. And it still is shocking to me that after all these years, the game has just had this rare, as you said, cult-like classic that people nonstop every single year celebrated and have events around it. It's weird.
Well, going back to when the game came out, I mean, there was quite a lot of, you know, controversial content in there, and lots of violence in the game too. And were there any kind of controversies related to the game's release? Because I know the game was actually banned in Germany. I read that at the time.
It was, yes. Yeah. They wouldn't allow red blood, and we didn't want to change it. So Virgin said, forget it. We're not going to release it in Germany, which made people want it even more through gray markets and through other areas because they couldn't have it. It's just crazy.
Do you think the controversial headlines and the gore and stuff, obviously it didn't sell at all in Germany, but do you think... You know, you said it sold all right. Do you think it helped with the sales? Do you think it would have done worse or better if there wasn't any controversy?
Gosh, you know, that's hard to say, guys. I really don't know. I mean, oddly enough, I think the game in the past, you know, 10 to 15 years, probably let's say 10 years or so, has gained more sales and more attention by a meaningful factor than it ever was when it was released on DVDs and at stores. I never would have guessed that it would still be selling as well as it is, you know, to this day.
Well, the game has a quite a unique blend of horror and satire as well. You know, there is humorous elements in the game too. I mean, why did you decide you wanted to get some humor into the game as well, as to kind of balance out the gore?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, you know, very disturbing imagery, but with also quirky imagery and headlines that you just, I guess, to catch people off guard, catch them when they weren't expecting it. And I won't certainly go through some of the imagery. It's all over. You know, you can see it over there. But, you know, sometimes some of the cutaway scenes from a guy who has half a body trying to protect a missile silo, you know, from the war, who's basically has no lower torso, to some completely different gory scene that I certainly don't want to go into, just snap from one to the other was just, you know, it kept people, I think, off balance a little bit. And I think that was the goal. Mm. You wouldn't expect it. It's not your classic, you know, scary ghost story kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, definitely, for sure. So how did you come up with the design of the user interface? Did you learn sort of any lessons from other companies like LucasArts or Sierra who were doing similar games at the time?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, and this is just being in the game business for as long as I have, you know, whether it's the games of today versus the games going back 20 or 30 years, no matter who you talk to, you know, whether it's, you know, Cliff Bleszinski or you know, certain really well-known guys that have been in the business for a long time, everyone gets inspired in their own ways, right? People have been inspired from books like Snow Crash and, you know, Ready Player One. And everybody forms their own uniqueness, but nobody really starts off in a vacuum. Most people don't start off in a vacuum, right? We all have this idea of what we think we like, and then we iterate it on it and build upon it. And I think one of the things that we loved about, you know, some of the LucasArts style games with the point and clicks and the King's Quest, the Space Quest and all the other different things was just the exploration factor of in the 2D world, right? Of having the magnifying glass, knowing that you've got to do something in the world, knowing that, you know, there's a solution to the problem, but you really have to really, really use your head to figure out, well, what is this magnifying glass? I know it wants me to look at it and I know what it says, but how does it tie to the bigger story? And how does it weave together to make sense as part of a larger message? And I think those were easy to understand games because everybody knew how to use a mouse and how to click something. That was pretty.
Yeah.
There wasn't a very, you know, like your WASD keys, right? When you're playing Quake, right? Dub lift, jump, jump, dub, 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 things, jump, spacebar, boom, WASD, boom, boom, kick, kick, boom, BFG gun. I mean, if you played Quake back in the day, we'd have Quake LAN parties. You had to have your left hand and right hand going all the time. I mean, it was just no way around it or you're dead. These games allowed people to think, take their time, and just immerse themselves in a story in a way that back then was just more of an accepted way of doing it.
And I think that Harvester actually nailed that kind of UI quite well, because you think back a few years earlier when, you know, Monkey Island, which is a game that I love, you play that today and the interface on there, you've got so many different options like turn on, turn off, push, pull. You know, it kind of felt like the user interface sometimes gets a bit in the way of the game. But I think by the time Harvester had come along, it simplified it a bit more and made it not get in the way of the gameplay.
And we tried to basically have a contextual icon based upon what you think you could do. So if you knew you had to examine something, you didn't have to switch between a bunch of different tools. It became a magnifying glass. Yeah. If you knew you had to grab something, it didn't switch. You have to switch between, you know, a bunch of different options. You simply had the hand and you grabbed it. You know what I mean? So we tried to do that again, you know, some with success and some probably less than such, but, I think in everything, you know, people get inspired in different ways and iterate on different things. But it was just a lot of trial and error. We had a whole story that we wrote, had to rewrite, and the team just did a wonderful job adapting to, I mean, stuff that we'd never done before. I mean, stuff that not a lot of people had done the full motion video frame by frame before. Yeah. It was always hand-drawn. Mm. So that for us was a huge, we had no idea what we were getting into, frankly. I think if we knew what we were getting into, we might not have done it, honestly.
I guess it was utilizing new technology at the time, you know, when FMV came along, it's like everyone wanted to do it, but obviously a lot of people couldn't. So I think the fact that, you know, you attempted it and actually released a good game using it, full motion video, I think is testament to your team's skills at the time.
Boy, that was so hard. Yeah. I mean, just coming, because we had to write our own video compressor.
Right.
And we didn't, you know, we didn't use, we tried to use third parties, but, you know, coming off of it, a DVD-ROM at the throughput we needed to, we couldn't get the quality that we wanted to. So we had a really smart guy young guy who was just really, really good at compression algorithms and doing it. Remember, we did it all in software, right? There was no hardware acceleration. That was another big Herculean effort that we, again, had we known, we probably would have done something else, but we just jumped in head first, you know.
So the game gives the players a lot of moral choices. And, you know, obviously you don't always have to do the nasty, I guess, you know, the nasty thing in the game. What was the background of this aspect? You know, was that kind of like just to kind of make a more unique gameplay, or was it kind of hoping some players would take the higher ground?
I think it was really more of an experiment you know, to see and peer into, you know, how people think, right? Mm. How people, and it was two things. One is some people would have, you know, be benevolent. Some people would say, you know, I'm going to take this route, which is, you know, the more, shall we say, gruesome sort of route. But I think the second reason we did it is because we were hoping that to the extent that people finish the game, as you see now in some games, right, only on a much larger, grander scale, they'd want to go back and save that game at a certain point and try and see what the different outcomes were if they chose the other path.
Yeah.
If nothing more than for adding some replayability and different perspective on had I chose one way, you know, the red pill, the blue pill, et cetera, and the ramifications of those choices. And I think I remember having, you know, playtesters play test the game, and we'd watch them. It was very odd how some would just, they would go right for that hardcore down bad path all the way through.
Yeah.
And then some would just take the right path all the way through. But then some people, they went half and half. They were in the middle. And I think it was an experiment on looking at people's choices.
Yeah.
As well as replayability and the ramifications of those choices as a player. That's all.
It's interesting human psychology as well, I guess, watching people play it to see.
Yes. Absolutely. Yeah. Very, very, very intriguing.
Well, you mentioned that, you know, obviously the game has achieved cult status now, and it's been re-released in recent years on platforms like Zoom and Steam as well. I mean, and obviously a whole new generation of gamers can play it easily now. I mean, how do you kind of feel about the game's legacy in the horror game genre?
Well, first of all, I never thought it would ever be that way. It just didn't. I mean, you know, I don't think anybody plans it out that way, at least back then. But it is nice to see. I'm just surprised, honestly. I don't know that people are still enjoying that game as old as it is. It's funny, I don't look at the reviews. I've never been a review guy, really. Actually, I try to stay away from as much as I could. But every once in a while, I think years ago, I looked at some of the reviews and things on Steam, and it's funny how if you go back, and I still have all the articles from the magazines back in the day, from places like PC Gamer and, you know, all these different sort of print publications, the game has more favorable people liking it now than they did back then.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, I don't know what changed about that. The game is the game is the game, you know. Certainly, I would have never guessed in a million years people would, you know, be printing T-shirts and capes and hoods and doing crazy things and seances and shit like that, or whatever they do on the pictures I see on Facebook every once in a while. So I'm, if anything, I think I'm just surprised that it has had the longevity that it's had.
And I guess it's easier today for a game to find its audience with the internet now, isn't it? And online stores, I suppose.
Yeah, I guess you're right, because, you know, back then, you know, you know, there was big publishers, you know, Interplay and Virgin and EA, and there wasn't, you know, like as many there are today, right? And there's only so much shelf space. And if you weren't one of the top, whatever that fits on the rack at Walmart or Game or anywhere else where you could buy your physical, you know, CDs, you're moved out for somebody else to come in.
Yeah.
Right. And now you're right. There's pretty much no limit, and I guess there's an audience for everything. So, but yeah, I'm certainly thankful for the fans that have played the game. It's just very odd that, you know, more people seem to like it now than they did back then.
You find that with so many games these days.
I know.
So you made a move to Virgin Interactive in 1997. What made you make that move, and what happened to DigiFX at the time?
So we were working on a new game, and as usual, when a small team happens and then, you know, you had a funding source that runs out, I always say there's, you know, two of the most hardest things in life are, one, laying off a bunch of people that felt like family when you ran out of money as a small studio. Mm. And the second is raising money. Yeah. Two of the most painful things, and I've done them both a lot. So I think just, you know, it was a lack of funding and we had to close the studio down, and I was done with games. I was angry. I was distraught. I didn't want to have anything to do with games anymore. I was, you know, I went through a very rough period where, you know, you spend a lot of time, money, and effort, including your own capital, to, you know, do things, and then you lose it, and you lose the team. And it's, as if you guys have ever run studios, it's really demoralizing. And so I went to work for ABC Radio Networks in Dallas. At the time, it was nice and safe, owned by Disney. ABC Radio was, you know, Disney Radio was there and everything. It was fine. And because Virgin had published my game and Harvester in Europe, I got to know the people in Irvine and the UK quite well. And they needed someone to really, who had been in the trenches, failed a bunch, which I had my certainly share of. And they wanted some out to come out and really be sort of biz dev, to look at games, to evaluate content that could become the next big franchise, cross-merchandise it, cross-port it, and do all the things sort of like built. And that was really, really where I began to really fall in love with the process of hitting every show on the planet, you know, then finding green-lighting games with the team, both at Virgin and Midway. I was at Midway for 13 years, and bringing franchises out of thin air, which made the company money, and really, really, really very fulfilling going down that road. And that I wasn't at Virgin that long before the company was sold to back to Electronic Arts.
Right.
And that's where, being in Orange County, was an easy move down to San Diego. Midway had a very large office at the time, of about 200-300 people down here. And Midway had internal studios and third-party studios. And because I was on the third-party side, my first big one I got greenlit was a game called Spy Hunter. Brought that back on the PlayStation 2, which was awesome. And, of course, we had Spy Hunter 2 and then Spy Hunter 3 with The Rock at the time, Dwayne Johnson. And bringing back Defender, which was the Defender was a really unique one in that, you know, it was one on a console game that, you know, brought in real time strategy elements along with real time combat, which was, you know, probably a little ahead of its time. But it was really, really, really fun because you had to think about the battlefield, and it was all in 3D, of course, and place units and drop them and have them attack things and fly in the air and shoot, you know, the bad guys out of the air. And it was probably my happiest time because I was working, you know, I ran the Japan licensing operation. So I'd be at twice a year Tokyo Game Show in Makuhari. And, you know, we'd license in content from Japan, and we'd license Mortal Kombat over to Japan and other content. But just to get to see hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of games every year. And every once in a while, you know, you come up with some crazy harebrained idea and feel so gratified when it becomes a good franchise. You know, a classic example was one of the senior executives at Midway said, we need an American horror game that can compete against Resident Evil. I'm like, wow, that's a really tall order. And so I started thinking about what would it be, and I had a large database of developers around the world, and I started sending out some ideas and got bad treatments, and out of it came a studio we ended up buying, but up in Seattle, and the game they made was called The Suffering.
Right.
And there became a franchise sequel to it. I ended up buying the company, and the game did extremely well for the company. And there's several other examples of those kinds of things. So those were probably the most fun, because for me, it was a combination of working with a team, just like we did at when we had the studio that was small, Future Vision Digipex, that came up with ideas, collaborated. I got to work with the production teams that were just super talented. And as a group, seeing a franchise that you just dreamed up, people supported and came to life was just, I mean, forget about the money. It was just a gratifying feeling to see things, franchises get built out of thin air, right? So I was there for 13 years until we sold that to Warner Brothers.
Well, Lee, you've had such an interesting and varied career in the gaming industry. And as we've mentioned a couple of times, you know, those Future Vision DGFX games, there are, you know, several of them available to play again easily on modern platforms. So if people want to check them out, I'll link those in the show notes as well. You know, someone might discover, you know, hearing us talking about it, thinking, oh, I've not played that before. You know, it opens up to new audiences, and, you know, someone might find a game that they really love out of it. So I think that's awesome. And thanks again for coming on, Lee, and sharing some of your memories. It's been absolutely wonderful to talk to you.
My pleasure, guys. Appreciate you taking the time to not let some of that old stuff die and keep it going. And I certainly am appreciative of it, and to all the fans and everyone else. So happy to help and answer anything I can anytime.